This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Back in 1962, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee set up a group called the Freedom Singers to carry the message of civil rights nationwide and raise the spirits of protest marchers and organizers. Here's a rare recording from the Smithsonian Folkways Recordings Collection of what happened at one SNCC meeting. One of the voices you're hearing belongs to Bernice Johnson Regan, who's with us today here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And you remember that moment by any chance?
Yes, and I also did the collection for the Smithsonian, which is Voices of the Civil Rights Movement, and it is a 2-CD collection, and all of the cuts are from field recordings of live mass meetings or organizational meetings during that period.
And was that as spontaneous as it sounded?
Yes.
That's remarkable. I can imagine even being able to pick out your voice in particular there.
Probably not. I think you're hearing Rutha Harris.
Rutha Harris, maybe?
Yes.
That really high voice?
Yes.
Yes. You have probably answered this question 100 times in the past week, but could you have imagined back in those days, in those meetings, that you would be this week in the White House with President Obama celebrating the music of the Civil Rights Movement?
No, we were really trying to change the structure of the local and state governments in the South that were organized by race. That was our target. And we really weren't thinking 50, 60 years into the future.
You were thinking 2 months, 3 months, 2 years down the road.
That's right. And getting masses of African Americans registered to vote to actually change the political structure in the South.
And how important was music to that effort?
I don't have any sense of the civil rights movement existing without the singing we did in marches, in mass meetings, and in jails. There is no separation. And for me, if I hear a program about the civil rights movement, if you're not listening to some of these recordings, I feel you've missed an opportunity to understand the energy and the voice, the articulate voice of the masses of people who stepped out of the old ways of being and just got in the way to change and give us a new situation.
I wonder, were the acoustics good in jail?
We actually didn't test acoustics for anything we did anywhere. If we were there, then we sang. And it's not a thing like you go, It was not that. You sang.
No, I just wonder if there was those concrete walls and all those very live surfaces, everything might have reverberated pretty good.
If someone locks you up in jail, there isn't a pretty good.
I suspect you're right about
so
that.
So part of holding on to why you're there, and partially if you're there with masses of people, you are able to have a proactive, positive experience, and the major carrier of that interpretation is the singing.
As we mentioned earlier this week, the White House held the latest of a series of evenings to celebrate the music that tells the story of America in honor of Black History Month. The event in performance at the White House, a celebration of music from the Civil Rights Movement, featured readings and songs from some awfully well-known names: Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, the Blind Boys of Alabama, Smokey Robinson, Yolanda Adams, and Bernice Johnson Regan's daughter, Toshi Regan. She's a singer-songwriter and a musician from Brooklyn, New York, also with us here with her mom in Studio 3A. And thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
And we want to hear stories from listeners as well about which civil rights song and which moment made a difference to you. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Toshi Regan, these songs must have come to you literally as mother's milk.
I was definitely raised on with a lot of music around me, but also with the understanding that it was that music is a vehicle of not just expressing ideas and thoughts, but a way to actually survive and sustain being a participant in a movement for change.
And that it was about the message and the heart as well as the music itself.
Yes, but it's also a way for individuals to actually not be alone, a way to really survive some, you know, horrible situations and some uncomfortable situations. You know, by bringing your voice and bringing your voice inside yourself and with others, it created a power and a way to exist in the world.
Bernice Johnson-Regan, you must be awfully proud of your daughter.
She's fierce. She's one of the fiercest people I know on the planet.
I wonder, was there a moment when you were 15 or so when you said, Mom, this music, it's getting a little old, don't you think?
Never.
Never? Not once?
Not a single moment.
Because she's pretty fierce, too.
She is a really courageous and innovative, forward-thinking person to this day. And she was very, she took me with her everywhere when I was young. And so any things that I then brought myself musically when I started to like Led Zeppelin or Kiss or any. She actually looked at it. She bought me my first Kiss concert tickets. Thanks, Wa. And she moved right along with me. So music has never gotten old in our family. It's a very alive, giant, growing tree.
We want to hear about which part of that tree back in the days of the Civil Rights Movement affected you, the moment, and what difference it made in your life. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Keely's on the line with us, calling from Moscow, Idaho.
Hi, it's just so wonderful to hear you talking about this. I'm almost 50, and I remember back in, it had to have been the mid-60s, my grandmother from Little Rock, Arkansas, who, as we say now, is a product of her generation. And no racism is ever benign, ever, but she was not at all a malicious person, just maybe ignorant. She came to visit my parents, who were very involved in the NAACP in Tucson. And I will never forget, and it still brings tears to my eyes, the image of we were at a rally, an NAACP rally, and here's my grandmother holding hands with people who she never thought she could talk to or should talk to, singing We Shall Overcome. And it was just an image that's burned in my mind forever. I'm just so grateful for the work that your guests have done. I'm grateful for the work that my parents and people like them did in fighting for civil rights. And I'm pretty sure it was an important moment for my grandmother because she was raised in an area that had some of the cruelest, most pernicious, racism in the United States. But here she was on a visit with us, holding hands with people and singing We Shall Overcome, and I think with all her heart meaning it.
That transformative moment. I mean, there were other things that went into that, I suspect, Keely, but the music sure helped.
The music absolutely helped. And again, I'm just so grateful to your guests. I'm glad to hear that Toshi is continuing the work of her mom. And I just bless you for the work that you did and for the work that we really have to keep, we've got to keep doing.
Thanks, Keely, for the call very much. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. Right. Beautiful.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I wonder, Bernice Johnson Regan, from the other side of the stage, you had to have seen moments like that. You had to have seen people, transform somehow.
It's very important to know that the first time I was involved in this movement was in mass meetings and in jail. And then the music in Albany, Georgia, struck people as being very, very powerful, and it's because of the congregational tradition. And out of that, Cordell Regan, who I later married, formed the Freedom Singers.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in Albany, Georgia.
That's right. And we did a national tour. And one of our jobs was to, in fact, find a way to go in front of audiences who were not on the line to talk about what was going on in the South, and we did it through song. And it not only gave people an opportunity to come closer, but also to search themselves to see if there was some way they wanted to participate in the change we were trying to bring about. And we did hundreds of concerts, and they always ended with We Shall Overcome, where everybody present stood and joined hands and sang what was then the anthem of the Civil Rights Movement.
Hmm. Bernice Johnson Regan is with us here in Studio 3, along with her daughter, Toshi Regan. They were both present at the White House earlier this week for the celebration of the music of the Civil Rights Movement there in the White House. This is a recording, as we go into the break, of Go Tell It on the Mountain, led by Fannie Lou Hamer, recorded in Greenwood, Mississippi in the fall of 1963. From the CD Voices of the Civil Rights Movement at Smithsonian Folkways. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. More on the Civil Rights Movement and the music that made it happen. This is NPR News and Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Tuesday night, between the two snowstorms that hit the Capitol, a group of musicians gathered at the White House to perform a stirring tribute to the music of the Civil Rights Movement. Stars such as Smokey Robinson, Natalie Cole, Jennifer Hudson, and the Freedom Singers, featuring Bernice Johnson Regan and her daughter Toshi Regan, sang anthems of that era. If you'd like to see this concert, it's going to be televised this evening. Check your local PBS listings. Right now, we're talking with Bernice Johnson Regan and Toshi Regan. And yes, I know I made a mistake in announcing the music that ended the previous segment. That was both of them, as a matter of fact, singing Oh Freedom. But we want to know which civil rights song moved you the most in the moment when it happened. Give us a call. Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And let's go to Denise. And Denise is with us from Fountain Hills in Arizona.
Yes. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Hi. I can remember this so clearly. It was 1964. I was at the University of Maryland, and George Wallace came to speak and to try to energize the anti-Civil War, civil rights movement. The meeting was at Coldfield House, and there were hundreds and perhaps thousands of students there. One part of the audience was waving Confederate flags, and the other part of the audience was literally singing, shouting, "We shall overcome." Mm. It was a very, very moving set of speeches, and it really energized me to support the civil rights movement.
I can
remember that on the dais with Wallace, he introduced several people, and he introduced them this way. This is a Jewish American. This is a Catholic American, et cetera. And I really was so offended. I thought, why aren't they just Americans?
Hmm. That was the unreconstructed George Wallace before his almost died in an assassination attempt and before he changed his way. But Bernice Johnson Regan, you were smiling at that recollection. Were you there by any chance?
No, this is my first account. I was smiling because what we're doing is having people come in with their memories. And so this listener has described a scene I can imagine and that I read about,
mm-hmm.
but she makes it so much more alive,
mm-hmm.
to feel the dialogue that was going on, and that song, the theme song of the movement, gave voice to a group of people in Coldfield House to express themselves. So
absolutely correct.
Thank you for calling in. That's when I had not felt so powerfully until you described it.
Thank you, and it brings tears to my eyes even today.
Thanks very much for the phone call, Denise. Of course, it was in Laurel, Maryland, later that George Wallace was shot, so a place that not too far away from that. Let's see if we can get another caller in on the conversation. And this is Valerie. Valerie calling us from Birmingham in Alabama.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm glad to hear this segment here. I'm a 44-year-old black woman. And the first time I sang the National Black Anthem was when I was 39. And I was with a singing group, the UAB Gospel Chorus. And we sang it in Dexter Avenue Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, oh, my God, even right now, it's bringing chills and tears to my eyes because I never listened to those words. But when I sang them and I had to think, oh, my God, what is this saying to me as a black person or as any American coming together to try to bring this world together in a civil manner? And when I heard those words and when I sang those words, it just took on a whole new meaning to me. And now I have the words, and I'm going to make sure that my grandchildren know those very words.
I can hear some of your grandchildren right there.
Great news.
Now, are you talking?
She's going to know too.
Excuse me. Are you talking about lift every voice and sing?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, the words alone are just moving. If people would stop and listen to words instead of beats, listen to what you're saying, what you're putting in your head, what you're putting out with your mouth, what people are listening to. I think a lot of times people say words don't hurt, but they do.
Yeah.
Because they can also hurt, they can help, they can hinder, they can harm, and they can lift you no matter what.
It's interesting. We got an email on this point from Shannon in Minneapolis. I was so moved by the reference to the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, at the Obama inauguration. I'm not black, but I still find the words to be at least as evocative of the spirit of America as the Star Spangled Banner. Would love to hear it used more as America the Beautiful has been.
Mm. Yes. And I learned that in elementary school. So one of the aspects of growing up in the South, in these schools, is we got a repertoire that really had something for us in terms of sustaining us in what was a segregated society. So that song has been a part of my repertoire since I was about 7 years old.
Hmm. And Valerie, I wonder, you heard it for the first time at the age of, at what age?
She sang
it. No, I didn't hear it for the first
time. Ah, you sang it for the first time.
At 39 years old, I sang the song, and I really just never paid any attention, none whatsoever, even though I heard it on every February for Black History Month.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Singing it. I never got it till I sang it myself.
That's right. That's right.
And at that particular venue, the on Dexter Avenue there.
Yes.
And being there in that setting, it was like, oh, my God. And then going to the Capitol and being at the area where they had that water fountain with Martin Luther King's words on it.
Yes.
And
yes.
Even when I went to the Lorraine Hotel for the first time.
Yes.
Blew my mind. I mean, it was just awe-inspiring.
Thank you.
Valerie, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I wonder, Toshi, as you listen to memories like this, you obviously come from another generation, closer to our caller's generation than to your mom's, obviously. What meaning do these songs have today, do you think?
They have a lot of meaning today. I mean, they're still alive. They're still in service. People still use them. I think of those songs as workhorses. they're continuous, you know. And many of the songs that were sung during the Civil Rights Movement were created way before the Civil Rights Movement.
Sure, and a lot of them were gospel songs.
Yeah, it's a great example of how people can pick up something and carry it around with them and make themselves known in any situation. So when we sang the song, Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around last night, I felt very alive. I didn't feel like I was singing a piece from a museum. I felt like I was singing a contemporary song, very much needed right now in the world.
Hmm. And Bernice Johnson-Regan, as you... A lot of the songs were adapted to the cause, were sort of brought into the movement. They weren't originally written for it.
The songs we have, you grow up in a culture that is threaded through, not with songs as much as with singing. You are singing, and in singing you collect songs.
Hmm.
So when you don't need songs, you need to sing. When you need to sing, the songs that fit why you need to sing come to your mind. And I still remember the first time I changed the words of a spiritual. It was because we were in a situation, it was the first march, and we were in a situation where we needed to be singing. And I started the song, and it was a 19th century text, and I flipped what would be trouble in the air to freedom in the air.
Hmm.
And so the songs were not adapted as consciously as I hear it when people talk about using it. It is like the song that you know must name where you are.
Hmm.
And so you get old songs that are from the 19th century. You get gospel songs that are being sung by gospel choirs right then. And when you are in the middle of a movement action, the songs have to textually support that action and the stance you're making. And it's a very simple shifting to make songs like this fit the contemporary situation.
Here's an email we got from Chris in Minneapolis. Your singing, dear Miss Regan, he sends it to you, your singing of Been in the Storm So Long on the Smithsonian Collection got me through my grandma's death a few years ago. Thank you for sharing your powerful, beautiful voice with the world. It's such wonderful music for the civil rights movements, but also for getting us through in daily life. And let's take a listen to that.
So long.
Can you tell us about the origin of that song and how that came to be a part of your repertoire?
I really can't tell you when I heard the song and when I started to sing the song. That particular time I sang the song, it was a poignant feeling. And that's an I song. That's an I song. That's not a we song.
Yeah.
And I was singing it. I was singing it solo. And I, during that time, I did very few solos. I was usually in a group. For instance, with the White House event, Toshi and I were there, but we were joined by Ruther Harris and Charles Neblett, also original freedom singers. So that I've Been in the Storm So Long is a song that says, this life is a turbulent, fierce one. And it's one where you're naming that you're in a heavy, heavy period. But it's a moving song. So when he says, I played it to get through the death of someone close to me, he is actually putting into his space a sonic musical energy that's going to move him so he's not paralyzed. Mm-hmm. It will move him through that time.
Through that storm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Another caller. Let's go to Denise. Denise with us from Sacramento.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I called because Martin Luther King, he really heightened our awareness to the struggles of the civil rights, and the song Lift Every Voice and Sing is very prominent to me. And I grew up in Paso Robles, California, and one of my brothers went and marched with Martin Luther King, and he came back and he taught us some of the songs. And on Sundays afternoons after church service, we would leap arm in arm, walk down the street, and sing a few of the songs. And we were never really harassed because Pastor Robles was so small, and the officers would let us do it because we were orderly and we never did disturb, you know, the peace. We would just sing, and we learned of that. And another thing that was prominent for me in my life is that my foster mother sang a song for Ronald Reagan when he was on his campaign tour, and when he became president, he had told her that if he made the presidency, he would call her to come and sing in Washington, you know, the national anthem. So that's what he did. Her name is Juanita Brooker, and he called her, and her and Pop were able to go to Washington for the week. And that is because of the struggles of our ancestors.
Yes.
And the struggle is not over. Yes. We have a long way to go.
Well, that's another thing we're going to be talking about as we continue in this program. Denise, thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
And thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
God bless.
We're talking with Bernice Johnson Reagan and her daughter Toshi Reagan about the music of the Civil Rights Movement celebrated this week at the White House. And again, you can watch the concert on your local PBS station tonight. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Maxine. Maxine with us from Philadelphia.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just wanted to send my greetings to Bernice. I worked with her many years ago in Mother Dust.
Ah, yes. Ooh, this is a singing sister. Yes.
I just want to say I did not march with Bernice. I wasn't really active with Bernice until I met her in the late 70s. And what I admired about Bernice was the way she taught a song. She not only, you know, you didn't only just learn the lyric, but you learned the history, the historical aspect of a song. I remember her doing a song called Fannie Lou Hamer that we had to do. And I just was absolutely enthralled with the way this woman taught. I have such high respect for her. Such a high regard for Bernice. My voice has changed a lot over the years, Bernice Reagan, but I just wanted to let you know that I learned so much from you over the years.
Tell us a little bit, Maxine, about what Mother Dust was.
Well, Mother Dust was a 12-member a cappella group that Bernice formed. And we just 12 women, 12 black women that came from seemingly out of nowhere. But that was just the power that this sister had, that this woman had on getting people together and to be proactive, you know, be active and be proactive. And we did, many of the songs that we did were songs of struggle, but she taught us, the one thing I remember was that she taught us that our voice was our first instrument. Mm. And there was a way that you could use that voice. And that's the one thing out of many things that I learned from her over the years, and I've kept it in my heart all this time. And I just wanted to let her know that I love and appreciate her for the teacher that she was.
Are you still singing, Maxine?
Yes, I'm still singing a little bit, but I'm doing a lot of writing, and I've worked with a couple of groups, and some of the things that she, when I mentioned Bernice's name, that she was my teacher. That's how I view her, as my teacher, and people have great regard for her. And when I mentioned that I worked with her, they're just, you know, why are they such enthusiasm? You know, well, it must have been great working with her. I said, Bernice was a hardline teacher. You know, but I just have such respect for her, and I'm so happy to have worked with her. I wish there was a time when I had marched with her, but just doing the music with her was enough in my life, and knowing her.
It's wonderful hearing your voice today, Maxine.
And thank
you for calling.
Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you for taking my call.
Bye-bye. And this time I think we do have Go Tell It on the Mountain, led by Fannie Lou Hamer, recorded in Greenwood, Mississippi in the fall of 1963, from Voices of the Civil Rights Movement on Smithsonian Folkways. More with Bernice Johnson Reagan and Toshi Reagan when we get back from a short break. And tell us your stories of the songs that you heard that made a difference. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We've been talking this hour about the music of the Civil Rights Movement after a concert at the White House on Tuesday that celebrated the songs and anthems of that era. Earlier that day, about 120 high school students from around the country participated in a workshop about the role of music in social change, and Sierra Rowe McNeil attended that Music That Inspired the Movement workshop. She's a junior at Duke Ellington School of the Arts in Washington, D.C. She's also with us here in Studio 3A today, and lovely to have you on the program with
Thank
us
Thank you
today.
So much.
It must have been an amazing day at the White House.
It was.
And it really was. You go to school here in D.C., so
yes, I do.
You see that building a fair amount of time, but going inside, that's something different.
Yes, it was.
What did you learn?
I learned so much, especially about the music, the things that a lot of the celebrities said, especially Miss Bernice. I wrote down so many inspirational quotes. Like, she talked about wrapping yourself in sound, how when you don't have anything else, when you wrap yourself in sound. And that was one of the quotes I really appreciated.
Bernice Johnson Regan is still with us, one of the original Freedom Singers, of course, well known also from Sweet Honey in the Rock, and her works now as the Professor Emeritus at the American University in Washington, D.C., and Curator Emeritus at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Her daughter, Toshi Regan, is with us as well, a singer-songwriter based in Brooklyn and founder of the band Big Lovely, and nice to have you with us today. And I wanted all three of you to react to this email that we got, from Rose in Salt Lake City. And she writes, "My mother has told me several times that anybody who didn't grow up during the 50s and 60s can't understand the feeling that people had that music could really change the world." And Bernice, I wonder what you think.
I'm a historian, so I know that when people come out of a certain period, they really have a sense that they understand that period and it's not accessible beyond that experience. So I spent a lot of time talking to people who were not there and telling them there are lessons they can access from that period. You do not have to have been born in segregation or slavery. You do not have to have traveled at the bottom of a slave ship to get to it sufficiently so that it is valuable input in who you can be in your time. And that's the lesson of learning cultural history, which means you're dealing with more than the written record. You're trying to access what human beings generated to get them through situations. And when you get that kind of thing, I encourage young people that they can know enough to make use and apply to the situations they have to address in their own time.
Toshi Regan, did you have to be there?
No, you didn't have to be there. I mean, you didn't have to be there. And I do think Mom said it so perfectly. I think there's this idea that when you come from other generations that struggled, and especially with the civil rights era, you know, it made so many changes, but it could be this perception that you say, oh, your time is better than ours. You have it better than we do. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's right. I think every era, every generation has its unique battle, its unique struggles. As human beings, we are constantly in the fight for righteousness. If we didn't consistently in every era fight for righteousness, the world would be a dark and horrible place. And so Sierra's generation has a lot on its hands, and they can use, just like what my mom said, you know, as sustenance, as information to deal with what they have to deal with, which I think is as intense as the civil rights movement, is as intense as the slave trade, as intense of any struggle that we've ever had in the world in the time of human beings. So,
and Sierra Rowe McNeil, let me turn to you. When I was your age, I kept thinking, oh, I'll never understand because I was never there. Of course, that is the period we're talking about. Do you need to be there to understand?
I think yesterday was so important, going to the White House and hearing them sing and speak, because they are living history. And a lot of us aren't going to get a chance to be in the room with them and hear them. And that was so important, just to feel the genuineness of the songs that you were singing. It came from your heart. You know, it wasn't rehearsed. We were feeling what you were feeling,
and yes.
I learned so much just within the words, the soul and the heart. You can tell it was within the words, and that was a lesson in itself.
I think too there's so much music in the contemporary situation, and you really feel you are accessing, you know, music all over the place. But if you sit in the singing of the Freedom Singers, you actually are introduced to another kind of musical sonic power. And in this case, it was unaccompanied in terms of not having a lot of electrical instruments, but there was no question that it actually filled all of the air in the room. And we are blessed that we can have access to things from other periods. But the one thing I think is very important is not to suggest to young people that because we did get some achievements And we don't have as much overt racism. They have an easier time. Because I find that every period has its challenges. And I hope that all young people search for the contribution they can make in their time to change things for the better. And that's a generational work that has to be identified by every young generation.
And I want to get to calls, and I know there's people waiting who are impatient, and I apologize, but I did want to ask our young visitor, Sierra, do you think that's true, that the kids your age think that there's still that work to be done, that that this time is as challenging as these times that we're talking about now?
I wouldn't say it's as challenging. I would say it was challenging in a different way. My teacher at school, Mr. Mark Williams, he asked me all the time, what are you about? You know, this our generation, we have to look for what our civil rights issue is. There are so many different issues around us, and we really have to look for it.
I think she just got a better grade in that teacher's course. Let's go on to hear from Scott. Scott's with us from Oxford, Mississippi.
Hello.
Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, it's Oxford, by the way. But Ms. Regan, my name is Scott. I'm a music student in Detroit, Michigan. And recently I've decided that I'm going to write my thesis on Dr. King's speech, the I Have a Dream speech. It struck me that the speech communicates so much through like you're saying, through a sonic impression, that I wanted to analyze it as a piece of music. And I've been, in my preliminary research, finding lots of links to freedom songs of the civil rights movement. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on any relationship between that and Dr. King's speech.
And remember, you're going to end up as a footnote here, so go ahead.
Yes.
What's very important for you is that there is a cadence that African-American preachers use. Dr. King was not as cadence-driven as, say, my father, who was a preacher who would be called a hooper. But in folklore and ethnomusicologists, people have taken sermons by African-American preachers, and they use them as to get to the musical range so that you're dealing with more than conversational speech. You are empowering in a kind of rhythm and rising voice. So I think you're onto a very important thing, but be sure to look at those disciplines. They're going to help you analyze that speech.
And I wonder, do you hear those same rhythms in the speeches of Barack Obama?
It is so wonderful to have a president who is articulate and just courageous and rises communication talk communication to such a high level. I just am thrilled. He's not a preacher.
No, he's not.
But he's rolling, boy. We were just waiting.
Scott, thanks very much, and she'll
good
expect a copy
you.
Of your thesis.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Here's an email. This from Pamela. High on the 20th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison, mm-hmm. I remember Sweet Honey's a Child Crying in South Africa. What a power, what education. Thank you very much. Of course, that was your song, too.
Yes, that was a poem by Otis Williams, who worked at the University of Maryland, that I set to music, and we sang it through that whole period where we struggle against apartheid and try to corral people in this country to understand our role in helping to end it and not support apartheid in South Africa. Thank you.
And Sierra Rowe McNeil, that's another struggle, again, that you think of as history. All of us lived through that moment and remembered seeing Dr. Nelson Mandela walk out of that mm-hmm. prison 20 years ago today. Mm-hmm. I wonder, when you were in that room with all of those people who had done all of those things, what did you and your friends, the 120 other kids that were there, talk about after you finished?
We just talked about the history that was made, us being in the White House.
No, the history you made.
mm-hmm.
Yes. And just being able to meet and hear from all these people. Like I said, they're living history, and our kids may not get a chance to experience what we experience, and it's really, really special.
And do you hope to get back to the White House someday?
Definitely.
What are you planning to do with your life?
Well, I'm very interested in journalism and international business because I believe that the future is international.
All right. Well, just stay out of the radio business. Anyway, I don't want any more competition. We're talking with Sierra Rowe McNeil, Toshi Regan, and Bernice Johnson Regan about the music of the Civil Rights Movement. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Diane. Diane's calling us from Iowa City.
Hi. Actually, speaking of international, is perfect. The one thing I wanted to comment on first, though, is I think it's striking. I listen to the program all the time.
Well, thanks for that.
And often the callers are predominantly male, and I find it striking how many of the callers have been women today. Mm. I last saw Dr. Regan at, we were on a transport bus at Dulles Airport together this summer, and we talked about a time we had been together when I introduced her. But I wanted to bring up the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in Norway. I was in Oslo for the ceremony. Wangari Maathai was the recipient. And not the day of the ceremony, but the next day, when they have all of the children perform these performances, after the end of that about three-hour series of performances, we all stood and we turned over the programs, and we were all to stand and sing, and it was We Shall Overcome. And it was in that moment, I mean, it was just a transformational moment, because we realized several things. One, it was so clear that this was the international, that this little Negro spiritual had become the international and global articulation of freedom, of hope, of justice. And it was also that all of us realized at that moment that it was exactly the 40th anniversary of when Martin Luther King had received the same Nobel Peace Prize. And so I just wanted to bring an international flavor to how the movement from the United States has grown and impacted the rest of the world.
And Diane, we've gotten so many calls about We Shall Overcome. We're going to go out with that before we finish the program today. But I know I and maybe some other people in this room want to remember, on what occasion did you introduce Dr. Regan?
Oh, it was the YWCA of the USA's national convention. And I did
in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh. And she complimented me on the way in which I rendered the poem and then introduced Maya Angelou, and they were also there as performers with Sweet Honey and the Rock.
Okay, well, now we got that straight. I think everybody remembers now. Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate
Thank
it. Bye-bye. Here's an email from David. In 1967, I was an impressionable young white student at San Francisco State. I had the opportunity to hear Eldridge Cleaver give several speeches, always ending with the chant, "Power to the People." I, along with many others, was energized and imbued with a sense of our own power and ability to make change in the face of overwhelming institutional entrenchment. Could your guest comment on this powerful phrase, chant, war song, for the movement, Power to the People?
Power to the People comes out of the black consciousness, black power, black nationalist movement that was after, that followed as an activist period after the Civil Rights Movement. And what you have there is a movement against racism, which is the Civil Rights Movement. And then as we move forward, we begin to look at what were we in the culture. And there was a period where we actually began to study and re-understand who we were as a people. And so the whole black consciousness, black power, black studies movement would have had on the most activist edge people in the street going, power to the people. And this is where you get your black mayors in cities. Mm-hmm. You get urban areas. You also get what we call urban rebellions. So that's that power to the people is a very activist, protracted movement.
And there was a spectrum from the Black Panthers to black mayors.
To black studies and African-American studies departments, sure, in colleges. And the colleges were not just the white colleges. We had to struggle with the black colleges to teach African-American culture and history. So the struggle was throughout the system. And Power to the People is one of the aggressive edges expressions of that period. I had then a group called the Harambe Singers. Harambe is Swahili, meaning let's pull together. So I was right there.
Bernice Johnson Regan with us here in Studio 3A. We thank her for her time today, along with her daughter, Toshi Regan, who was kind enough to be with us as well. Thanks as well to Sierra Rowe McNeil, a senior at Duke Ellington's High School of the Arts here in Washington, D.C., who attended the workshop, Music That Inspired the Movement, at the White House. Thanks very much for coming in. We want to end with this email that we got from Carol. I'd like to contribute my memory about listening to the Civil Rights Freedom Movement song Affected Me. I was visiting the capital of the Soviet Union, Moscow, in 1975. We visited a high school dance, and the students stood in a large circle with us, took hands, and sang We Shall Overcome, with which we joined. I was so moved that this group of Russian high school students knew our American history and songs of freedom. This We Shall Overcome, recorded at a mass meeting in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in 1964. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.